Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 155 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and allow me to introduce my co-hosts. First is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. He's also our Airplane Geeks historian and military aviation expert. Hi, David.
Wow, I get more and more titles every week.
Yeah, but they're all fitting.
Well, thank you, Max. You're way too kind.
No, not at all. Also with us is Dan Webb. He's from the Things in the Sky blog, also our resident college student. Hi, Dan.
Hey, what's going on?
What are you studying again? Finance, is that it?
Yes. Well, a business administration with a concentration in finance and minors in actuarial math and supply chain management.
Wow.
I think.
How exciting. So,
That's college.
I live a very, very exciting life. Why I'm still single.
And you're going to be entering your senior year?
Scarily, yes.
Wow. Pretty soon you'll be looking for a real job.
Yeah, well, you realize the first time I was on the show, I had yet started college.
I know, it's hard to believe.
So feel old.
I do. And speaking of old, we also have Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Nice segue.
Hi, Rob.
Yeah. Hang on there, Sonny. Don't be speaking quite so quick here.
Oh,
I'm not quite ready for this kind of hullabaloo.
So
just take it easy.
Don't vibrate yourself.
Go easy on me now.
Okay, I promise.
All right.
Our guest this episode is Bryce Couillat. Now, he's been flying since 1999. He's got about 6,000 hours, and that includes night cargo along the Gulf Coast in a C-310 and a BE-58. He's flown Lear 35, caravans in Africa, and experimental Navy surveillance aircraft. Also, he's been in the charter business, I guess, in the Caribbean. But wait, there's more. He also has a glider commercial instructor license, and he flies with the Cleveland Soaring Society. And Bryce, I understand now you fly low-level atmospheric research aircraft over the Pacific.
I operate one of the pilots on the Navy's only twin otter, and we do a lot of experiments with it off the California coast.
Wow. Okay, we're going to have to talk about that for several reasons, one of which is that the twin otter is my favorite airplane that I've never been in, so we're going to have to talk about that. So, Bryce, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the aviation news from the past week. We'll have a great conversation with Bryce about his adventures. David has his This Week in Aviation History segment. We also have an Australia Desk report and Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment on European aviation. But first, let's get started with some aviation news. Everyone ready?
I hope I can make it through the news, because if I die...
Okay, our first story. Design exemptions pave way for rotable aircraft. This comes from AOPA Online. Now, it turns out that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, also called NHTSA, has granted the Terra Fugia petition for a temporary exemption from four different federal motor vehicle safety standards. Now, we've talked about the Terra Fugia transition aircraft, both, I guess, in the past. And this is sometimes called a flying car, but the Terra Fugia folks prefer to refer to this as a rotable airplane. Now, they've been kind of challenged a bit trying to get through some of the regulatory hurdles. But the problem with a vehicle like this, of course, is that you've got to satisfy not only the FAA, but you got to, for the airplane part of it, but you've got to satisfy the DOT for the road car part of it. And what's happened here is that NHTSA has granted them some exemptions, and I think it's for things like the windshield. They're going to be able to use a plexiglass windshield instead of the kind of glass that you would find required in an automobile. And there's also something about the tires and wheels, and I understand Terra Fugia is going to be using more of a motorcycle-style wheel and tire than they had originally planned. So, guys, it sounds like, you know, the folks at Terra Fugia have been working hard and maybe moving closer to making this a reality. So who's lined up to buy one? Anyone?
I saw this wife. For the first. Oh, go ahead.
Say, being a pilot doesn't pay well enough to fly much for fun, so I'm out of that option.
Yeah.
I saw this the first time up at Air Venture, I think 2 years ago, and everybody was kind of laughing at it, to be honest, because this is not the first time that somebody's tried to make a flying car. But these guys seem to be seriously on the move here. I was trying to figure out what the price was. I thought I saw it somewhere, but I don't remember what it was, because that's going to make a huge difference, obviously.
Yeah, I think it's not inexpensive. I should check, but I think I recall seeing somewhere around $250,000. So it's certainly more than something for just the casual pilot. But it is it falls under the light sport aircraft rules. Although I think they have an exemption for that too. I think they might have a slight weight exemption for this. But it's supposed to be an LSA. I think they're looking to begin deliveries next year in 2012.
I wonder what kind of mileage it gets on the road.
Yeah, or does it matter?
Yeah, exactly. Because it is pretty cool the way the wings fold up. It looks like an aircraft, like a fighter, before it gets sent downstairs on a carrier.
Yeah, exactly. I saw one of these also last summer, and the whole wing folding process is actually very quick. It's a simple process. It's motorized. You don't have to manually retract and extend the wings. There's motors that do that for you. But it's an interesting concept. And I think the way that they're looking at this is more of an airplane. But if you're out and the weather turns against you and flying becomes difficult, you can just fold up the wings and drive it away from the airport and beyond your way. So interesting concept. I think people are rooting for them because it'd be kind of nice to have something like this as an option.
It is pretty cool. Yeah, it is. It's going to replace airliners.
Well, it would certainly add to the drama of a trip. Okay, our next story comes from, this is actually a press release from the office of U.S. Senator Jim Inhofe. Now, he's a member of the Senate General Aviation Caucus, and he's also a certified flight instructor. This article says he's got more than 10,000 flight hours, and he's introduced a bill. It's called the Pilot's Bill of Rights. And he says, and this is quoting him, "Over the course of my years in Congress, I've helped an untold number of pilots facing the pressure of dealing with the FAA. This bill remedies many of the most serious deficiencies in the relationship between general aviation and the FAA and ensures the pilots are treated in a fair and equitable manner. One of the reasons I got into politics was to fight for the everyday citizen," okay, here's the politician coming out, "facing an uphill battle with bureaucracy, and that's why I'm so pleased to introduce this legislation. It's a mixture of my love of flying and pilots and my job of legislating for the people." Well, Bryce and Rob, for you pilots out there, do we need a pilot's bill of rights?
I think the last thing the FAA needs more, or the last thing aviation needs, is more government involved with it. I'd like to see less FAA, not more congressmen. But this guy obviously thinks AOPA is a more important lobby, because the Obama administration is no fan of aviation, that's for sure.
Don't get me started. Yeah, it's fun. When I read details about this, I guess I was having a little trouble figuring out what all the hoopla was. I didn't quite see anything that was really jumping out at me as a pilot, I would say, oh my gosh, this is wonderful. We've got to have this. But, when we're going to put the link up in the show notes, right?
Yes.
I was going to say that I maybe some of our listeners will go read this story. Maybe they'll take something away differently, certainly, than what I did. But I just, looks like a lot of politics to me.
It is kind of funny. I poked around at it, and it turns out that Inhofe has kind of an interesting history. I dug up an AvWeb article from last year, October in 2010, and he apparently had a little incident himself.
A little landing incident.
Absolutely correct, yep.
Right.
Yeah, that's the guy.
He landed on a closed runway that had maintenance workers on it.
He was very flippant about it afterwards, too.
Yeah, there's a quote from him on that, and he says that he won't guarantee he'll be more vigilant about checking NOTAMs. He said, I know, that's which is incredible. We'll explain that in a second.
And that's what part of this Bill of Rights is. So I thought maybe at first when I read this, I thought maybe this was a little tongue-in-cheek, but I guess it's not.
Yeah. Now, for the listeners who are not pilots, why don't you tell us what a NOTAM is, and more importantly, what it means to a pilot?
Well, a NOTAM is it stands for Notice to Airmen, and it's something the government puts out on a regular basis to inform pilots of situations they need to be aware of. It could be a runway closed at an airport. It could be a navigational aid that's out of service or out of service in certain places, lights that are out of service, just everything you might need really to know in order to conduct a safe flight into a particular area. And they're categorized by location. So that everybody doesn't have to see everything.
So, Bryce, do you just ignore NOTAMs?
Quite frequently. Actually, I don't get a flight briefing at all. I figure if it's my time's up, my time's up. No, I think what Senator Inhofe did is reprehensible, and I think the way he was so flippant about the risk of life and limb afterwards, I would really like to see the AOPA or any aviation group approach him and say, thanks, but no thanks, buddy. We don't need your help, and we'd really like it if you don't represent us. I mean, it really goes a long way to just show what kind of purpose drawn to politics.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, I also saw that, you know, for his transgression of landing on that runway, the FAA at the time did decide to sanction him, but the penalty was remedial training.
Mm-hmm.
Which means he had to have a little discussion with an instructor, who in one news story I read, it was actually a guy that that Inhofe trained himself as one of his former students. So
now there's an interesting one. I didn't realize this. You mean Inhofe is a flight instructor?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God.
I know.
Ugh. All right. Well, that's interesting.
Okay, let's move on to an article from Air Transport World. This is BioJet to release 1 billion gallons of jet fuel. That's right, 1 billion gallons. So there's this company. They're based in Santa Barbara, BioJet International. And this article says they've announced that it will release 1 billion gallons of renewable jet fuel priced at, now get this, $2.97 a gallon to airlines to, quote, aid in the development of biofuel in the commercial aviation market. Wow, $2.97 a gallon. That's far below what jet fuel costs, right?
Yeah. What did I give you guys when I sent this? I think I gave. Oh, there it is. Yeah, jet fuel as we're doing this at LaGuardia. Of course, I grant you, that's retail is $7.30 a gallon. I mean, the airlines would not pay quite the same amount. A regular corporate customer that was on a fuel plan would not pay quite that much, but it's still.
Yeah,
it's sure. Still going to be an enormous amount of money. That I mean is a far cry from $2.97.
Well, according to the lovely one of my favorite websites, is it sad that one of my favorite websites is the Energy Information Administration?
Yeah,
but anyway, according to the EIA, the spot price for granted this data is updated weekly, but the spot price for U.S. Gulf Coast kerosene type jet fuel. At 302. So, granted, that's spot.
Not, that's not the delivered price.
That is spot, but I'm just wondering how much that $7 price seems really, really, really high.
Well, it is, and that's why I picked LaGuardia. But typically, at a fixed base operator, if the retail price of fuel is $7.30, they're probably going to get yelled at for this, but they're probably making $2.25 a gallon, maybe profit, maybe $2.50. So that difference between that price and the spot price is pretty much what it costs them to get the fuel, which is another markup, of course. So anyway,
well,
not nice.
No one is against moving forward with biofuel, right? There haven't been any downsides other than in the past, other than cost. And, you know, do you have a distribution system? There have not really been any other downsides, right?
No, I just don't think it's that far along in the development process. Well, I mean, some ways, but not, you know.
Well, one issue for biofuels, depending on how you look at this from a sustainability perspective, is is how it affects food prices.
Right, because you don't want to compete for food.
Which has been one criticism of corn-based ethanol. It's because you're diverting, you're driving up corn prices, which obviously increases the price of corn, but will also leak into other products like beef.
And I don't know what kind of resources Biojet has. I don't know if it's, you know, Jatropha or algae, or I'm not sure where they're deriving their biofuel from.
The Air Transport Association announced last month, actually, that a few airlines, mostly Air Transport Association members, but a couple others, I believe, signed an agreement with a group called Selena Fuels, which will be providing biofuels at some of the Bay Area airports. And apparently, I don't know exactly what their fuel source, but they're saying that this will be diverting waste from landfills. I'm assuming some kind of waste product. But
sounds great.
So apparently, according to this, their facility will produce up to 16 million gallons of jet fuel per year by 2015. Actually, it says 16 million gallons of neat jet fuel. I have no idea what neat jet fuel is.
That's with no ice.
Well, that's what I was thinking, but then I was like, that doesn't
way to go, Bryce.
That was my first reaction as well.
Yeah.
You don't want ice in your jet fuel. That's a big thing.
That's for sure.
I think it's a great step forward. I don't know, NASA and the U.S. Navy are really looking at algae being grown around the San Francisco Bay Area as fuel for ships, which is a fairly broad cut of diesel. But I think this stuff would have a really bright future in turboprops. You know, middle altitude, we don't have to worry too much about anything growing in the field. We don't have to worry too much about ice.
Right.
Turboprops are a lot more forgiving on crappy fuel. I think it's fantastic as long as it doesn't compete with food, whatever the cost is. I think it's a great step forward.
And I think the other important thing, and we've talked about this before, is that it needs to be a drop-in fuel, really, for this to work.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems to be so far.
And maybe one day, one day, we can have aircraft that run on love.
Southwest already does.
That's right. It's called Southwest, yeah.
Dan, but for your airline, it'll be BS. It'll run on.
Methane.
See, now, I would have thought you'd have said that to me, but I think Dan is growing into his own here. I mean, I really do.
It was a good shot. Next article comes from Mercury News. TSA warns of implant bombers, prepares flyers for swab tests. Boy, this is really raising a ruckus.
If the scanners can see right through you, and the dogs can smell you, and the metal detectors can detect all kinds of goodies, I mean, is it going to make any difference? I mean, will they be able to camouflage this stuff inside of something?
I'm not sure exactly how deep the body scanner can see.
Not to see very deep at all, just through the clothing. But the TSA just admit that a lot of their machines are putting out something like 10 times too much radiation. So who knows? Who knows what they're putting out?
Maybe they can see.
They might be able to see in the next week.
Well, the TSA has apparently told the airlines that some terror groups are believed to be experimenting with different explosives that could be implanted. Article mentions in buttocks and breasts. And there's no specific...
Was that the name of the magazine?
Huh?
Was that the name of the magazine? I'm sorry, but that was a real...
Buttocks and breasts.
Oh, man. We should have avoided this one, I can tell right now.
So this also means that all ladies that are over a particular size are going to be scanned differently.
I don't know.
I would like to point out that I have been very good and have avoided any inappropriate conversation on this topic.
Okay, Mr. Webb. We'll expect you to keep it that way, too.
This is all Rob's fault.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, the best part about this is no matter what I do, either Rob or Dan gets blamed for it.
It works well, huh?
I'm not sure how I lucked out, but that always seems to be the proper procedure.
It does. Well, you know, the most interesting thing I've seen in the articles on this topic have been the a huge number of reader comments, and they pretty much seem to be running about 8-2, maybe 9-1, along the same theme, claiming that, you know, this is obviously a bogus move by the TSA to justify themselves, that this is, you know, inappropriate, they're out of control, and, very down on the TSA for this. What do you guys think? I mean, is this a political move by the TSA?
I think the TSA is the greatest threat to liberty in the United States right now. I despise the TSA. When I was flying charter, having to deal with TSA on almost a daily basis, getting people in and out of airports, trying to move them in and out of the country when we're in the Caribbean, it was the worst part of my job. They are they're not professional. Customer service doesn't matter to them at all. They've never stopped or thwarted a terrorist threat in the United States. The underwear bomber and the shoe bomber were both brought to justice by passengers.
Right.
They have a high failure rate on their own investigations, something like 70%. It's despicable that we have to pay for this violation of our Fourth Amendment every time we want to travel.
And Bryce, that's exactly the kind of sentiment that people who commented on the article and several others as well expressed. That's how people feel these days. And I don't know if it seems like the TSA just doesn't have a lot of friends right now.
Well, good grief. Why would they? I mean, you know what I think I probably despise more than anything about them? Sorry, I know blogger Bob is our buddy, but he's probably used to this anyway. Is that these guys and these ladies act as if they're law enforcement officers, and they're not. I mean, they have a badge that came from Department of Homeland Security, but they're not law enforcement officers. I just don't think they got that memo, though.
Hmm.
I want to know who did the threat analysis, because where is this coming from? Who decides that all of a sudden that the threat of the week is resolved by swabbing people down? I mean, there has to be some guy sitting in a room, or girls sitting in a room, and they have to come up. Somebody needs to present them something for them to decide that the directive is we're going to start swabbing people down.
Well, you know, there must be some basis for this, right? I mean,
They told me it's just random. They told me it's just random when they do that.
I think somebody watched The Dark Knight and saw the part where the guy has a bomb inside of him and freaked out.
Oh, okay.
That's the level of thinking I get from TSA.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, I'm not going to try to defend them because certainly with this crew, it would be futile.
This guy Bryce is kind of a troublemaker, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he says what he thinks.
I opt out every time. I travel across the country several times a month, and I opt out of the body scanner every single time. And I wish more people would do that. Just despicable to me.
You mean because it slows the whole process down?
Yeah, yeah. I think if we could get a solid day of upwards of 50% of the passengers opting out, the airlines would be crippled with their schedule for days afterwards. They would have to do something. I don't know where's the outcry from United and Continental and American. Where is the industry push away from this?
Because, you know why there's no push? Because the passengers don't care.
Yep. They're sheep.
There's no
sheep
pushback on the passengers.
I find nothing redeeming about the TSA in any way, shape, or form.
Okay. that's pretty clear.
I will probably get a real hard time next time I fly out of San Francisco now.
Yeah, you probably will. You're probably on a list now.
Yeah, right. No doubt. If I wasn't before, I am now. 3 17-year-long background checks with the U.S. Navy, and I still have to go through a body scan.
Yeah, so. I know. All right, Dan, do you want to tell us about some airlines in South America?
Yes. Late last week on Friday, it was announced that the Brazilian airline Gol acquired a much smaller Brazilian airline, Webjet. So I guess this is interesting to see this consolidation going on in South America. Granted, this isn't really the scale of something like Avianca Taco or LAN and TAM. But
I've heard of fish tacos. I've heard of beef tacos. But what the heck's an Avianca Taco?
No, Avianca, Colombia, and Taca merging.
I'm on fire tonight.
Yeah, David, you are.
But anyway, it is interesting to see this kind of consolidation in Brazil, because Brazil has been a very quickly growing market. Whereas in the mergers we've seen here in the U.S., it's been more consolidation in a relatively mature aviation market in terms of commercial aviation. So it's just been interesting to see that. Though granted, the other reason I kind of brought this article up is I'm just kind of ignorant in this area. So I was hoping maybe we had some listeners who knew more than I did, might be able to provide some input. But Brazil's just been interesting to watch. I mean, especially the airline that I've been enjoying watching is Azul, which has been launched by David Neeleman of JetBlue fame. And it's just it's a growing market. I mean, it's very interesting when you see a carrier like Azul, where it's really opening up air travel for the first time to many consumers in that country.
Now, is that also a low cost carrier?
Yeah. So it's basically for some of these routes, it's the airline is really more competing with bus travel. So have a low cost carrier that can charge not that much more than the bus company, well, you know, if it's a, I'm just making these numbers up, but a 1.5 hour flight as opposed to an 8 hour bus ride through the mountains, you know, the airline can win. So it's just interesting to see this. Also, other things that's been interesting, Webjet actually is kind of is just an interesting airline, considering that Ryanair was talking to them last year, according to a couple articles I found. Also interesting is the fact that Webjet was acquired for 96 million reals, whereas and according to the Gold press release, the value of Webjet was 310 million. So I was just wondering, you know, what was
why the discount?
That seems like why the discount. So it's just it's just an interesting consolidation. Granted, I'm a bit of an ignorant observer here, so like I said, I was more interested in bringing this up to see if there are any listeners we have with a South American knowledge base that we can draw upon.
Okay, that's good. You also provided us with a article from Vanguardia, which is in Spanish.
So yeah, well, it's actually just one of the few articles I could find about this issue other than going directly to the Department of Transportation docket. But this is a very... Mexico has been fun to watch ever since Mexicana ceased operations. I believe it'll be a year next month.
Feels about right.
Yeah, and they still haven't come back. So the low-cost carrier Volaris, which has been a carrier that I've been watching partially because they're partnered up with Southwest, they've been able to take advantage of Mexicana dropping out of the market. As you would imagine, if you knock out a major competitor, that kind of good news. So, but
it helps,
but there's,
right?
But there's an interesting regulatory item that came up recently with Volaris. Basically, there is a bilateral between Mexico and the United States that deals with air travel. And basically, there are, for most markets, there can be two Mexican carriers and two American carriers. And there are, I believe, 14 markets that can have up to three on each side. So Volaris recently applied to the DOT for extra bilateral authority to operate service from Monterrey to Chicago and from Mexico City to Las Vegas and also to Los Angeles. So what's interesting is these routes, both carriers on the Mexican side have been assigned. I believe it's Aeromexico and then along with Mexicana. And basically Volaris is saying Mexicana's frequencies on these routes cannot be reassigned while they're in bankruptcy protection, but there have been negative effects on the traveling public because of this. So can we possibly have the authority to operate these on a conditional basis? So, and then once Mexicana comes back, we'll stop operating it. But in the interim, why can't we fly?
Interesting argument.
Yeah. So it developed a little bit further last week when American had their own filing, basically saying, "Hi DOT, if you're going to approve Volaris's application, you should approve our application." And American has applied for extra bilateral authority operate from JFK to Mexico City. But what's interesting is there are two American carriers operating that route: Delta from JFK and Continental /United/Continental from Newark. So it's a slightly different argument, even though Mexicana did previously operate that route. So sometimes the regulatory side of the business is very interesting to follow. So no decision has been rendered as of yet, but I just found it to be an interesting argument.
And who again renders the decision?
I'm no expert in the legal side, but both of these were applications to the DOT. I believe they'll be making the final word, and if I'm recalling correctly, in Volaris' application, they had a letter from the Mexican government endorsing the idea. So,
All right. So we'll watch and see what happens next.
Yeah, the DOT docket is a very fun place to be sometimes. No, seriously, it's actually one of the few places you'll... I mean, it's very rare where you'll see in the public airlines really calling out each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess a lot of times in the media, you'll see airlines saying, you know, oh, we'll always be a strong competitor and or something of that nature and never really do anything. But the airlines can get really vicious on the DOT docket.
Again, our guest this episode is Bryce Couillat. Bryce, when you sent me some of your background, you wrote that you have an MES and an MEL, ATP, an MEI. I have no idea what that means. A CFII, I know what that is, and a CFIG, when I don't know what that is. So in the interests of, sort of education, we'd like to have some, learning experiences in this. And I know Rob knows what all those things are. Maybe you could give us kind of a rundown on what all that means.
So the MES and the MEL just refers to multi-engine sea and multi-engine land airplanes. And then the ASL, that's aircraft single-engine land. So, when you ever see MEL or SEL, it's single-engine or multi-engine land or sea. And then the CFIG is flight instructor for a glider.
Oh, for glider, sure. Okay. Yeah, I want to talk about gliders soon. But first off, though, tell us what you're doing over the Pacific Ocean these days.
For the last couple of years, I've operated an experimental Navy airplane that was built to be a surrogate predator. You guys know that predators and other UASs, UAVs,
sure.
Unmanned aircraft,
yeah.
are they have to remain within restricted airspace in the United States, at least for now.
Right.
So whenever the military wants to do an exercise or somebody wants to do an exercise where they need a predator-type asset outside of restricted airspace, this aircraft can fit that bill, and we can actually operate for a very small fraction of the cost of an unmanned aircraft. And plus, you have somebody in the airplane. So you can operate in different places. You can ask the guy in the airplane what he sees sometimes. And but now, I still do that. I'm an instructor on that aircraft now. I've moved into the Twin Otter, which we use for a lot of atmospheric research. We just finished a mission last month where we flew over most of California at 1,000 feet or lower, trying to find out what kind of emissions oak trees put off, if you can believe it's worth the money to do that.
Huh, no,
but we
sure,
did
yeah.
that.
Huh.
Yeah, and then we did some drop son experiments with some different organizations last week, and for the next 2 weeks we'll be working with a couple universities checking out the emissions from ships. Checking out the low stratus layer over the ocean, just really checking out the atmosphere and, I guess, figuring out more ways to measure the kind of damage we've actually done to the planet and possible ways to prevent doing more damage in the future.
Now, when you say we, who's the we that's doing this?
There's a lot of hands in the cookie jar. I operate with a group that's part of the Naval Postgraduate School here in Monterey, California. There's a lot of different organizations, with a lot of the Caltech, Surpass, there's just a lot of alphabet soup. But it's basically the U.S. Navy through a lot of contractors.
That's interesting.
It is. I'm still trying to figure it out. It's been 5 years.
Well, you really fly a variety of things. Now, where did you start your aviation career?
I learned how to fly at Kent State University in Ohio. I started right out of high school. And that was actually my first flight lesson was the second time I'd ever been in an airplane. And up until the time I was really about 25 years old, the largest aircraft I'd ever been in was a Lear 35, and I was flying it. So I really just always knew I wanted to be a pilot. I never had enough money to really do anything except pay for training. Mm-hmm. I never really got to travel or anything when I was growing up, so it just it's been a real process of discovery.
Was there some breakthrough event or something that really kind of kicked things off for you in terms of flying?
Not that I remember. I mean, my mom says I just always wanted to be a pilot, and I was always obsessed with aircraft and built a lot of models and read about it when I was growing up. And I think she took me to a small air show in Medina, Ohio, when I was 14, and I got to fly in an L3 Bird Dog for about 20 minutes, and that was fantastic. But I'd already knew well before that what I wanted to do. And I've got to get to do it. Piloting, the reason pilots are so obsessed with flying is that we're one of the few professions where we grow up to do what we always wanted to grow up to do.
Yeah, yeah. Rob, is that what you always wanted to do, fly? Or did you grow up with something else in mind?
I actually had a couple of other thoughts. I wanted to be a veterinarian at one time, but then I realized I didn't like cutting up critters. So the only thing left was to fly. Yeah, that was the only thing left. No, I was kind of like Bryce. I was an airplane geek probably at about 8 or 9, I think. And everybody that knows me, all the relatives have tons of stories about the same thing. So
yeah.
I think it's one of those things where you just know you love it. And I mean, look at David. Oh, my gosh. I mean, this guy, you know, David, I hate to pat you on the back again. I don't want your big head. I mean, but, you know, there wasn't anything that was going on when we were at the Smithsonian that he couldn't explain in detail.
Yeah, I know. It was great.
Sometimes excruciating, but that's okay. You know, seriously, I mean, that's a geek. That's a guy that really just does it because he loves it. And that's, you know, that's what you want to see in anybody in any profession. That's what people look for.
Absolutely.
So, Bryce, with you, did gliders come later on or early on? When did you get into gliders?
I've never had a flight review. I've always just learned how to fly something else every other year. And we were doing a mission in Yuma, Arizona at MCAS. And I had just always been interested in gliding. I knew there was a lot of gliding in Arizona. And I found a tremendous glider port in just south of Phoenix, run by Jason Steven. It's called Arizona Soaring. I highly recommend it. Hmm. We've had guys from Ohio make the trip to Arizona just to fly with this guy. He's a phenomenal instructor. And I went out there to Arizona Soaring, and I knocked out my commercial glider in about 2.5 days. And then I went back a few weeks later and got my instructor, and I just had to figure out, you know, how do I make it worth the expense of becoming a glider instructor is the only way to start flying gliders to teach people. So that's what I do now, and it's phenomenal. I wish I would have found it I wish I would have learned how to fly gliders before powered aircraft.
So interesting. From a pilot standpoint, how would you characterize the difference between glider flying and powered airplane flying?
Well, number one, you're not going anywhere. It's in circles. So it's really flying for the joy of flying. It's really as much of a mixture of art and science as I think aviation has to offer. It's very, very stick and rudder, and I know that's a cliche, and I hate to hear it as well, but it really is all about seat of your pants, looking outside. You're looking for thermals and lift that you cannot see visually, so it's a very visceral experience, and it's low speed. It's just pure joy. Even if it's only a 20-minute up and down, we can't find any lift, you just come back and land, and there's no go around, so every landing has to be really good. It's a great test of piloting skill, and I think some of the younger people that we have in the club, the 13, 14-year-olds, through this experience, I think it's just going to improve their piloting skill for the rest of their life. I would venture to say that people who want to fly gliders first will probably end up being more skillful pilots in the end.
Interesting. I was going to ask you about the Cleveland Soaring Society. How many people are in that group, and what kind of planes do you have?
We've got 30 to 40 active members right now. And we have, four club ships. One's grounded. One's an L-13 that the FAA recently grounded every L-13 in the country for what I consider a bogus reason. But, you know, we have some single-seat gliders and some two-seat ships. We're the fastest growing club possibly in the nation. Most soaring schools are shrinking right now, but we've actually had quite an influx last year. We actually went out and bought another glider. And it's a great crew. It's a great social environment. And the flying we do, to see those, Ohio is not exactly a mecca of glider flying. It's when you think of glider flying, it's Nevada, Arizona, Southern California. So to see that many people really get enthusiastic about it, you know, it's a great social club as well.
And so is everyone in the club a pilot?
No, we're actually, I think, 80 to 85% students right now.
Oh, wow.
And there's only three instructors, and I'm out here in California for the summer. So, you know, we do our best to keep it together, but students are oftentimes more enthusiastic about it than guys who've been flying for decades. You know, it's really great to get young people and even people in their 40s and 50s out there who just want to learn how to fly gliders, to see that kind of that interest and that passion in somebody we have people who are in their 60s and 70s and want to learn how to fly gliders. It's absolutely phenomenal. It's a really great mix of people. And I'm not just saying that because they're listening. They're good people.
And if someone is hearing this and is thinking, wow, this is something worth checking out. Are there many glider clubs, soaring groups around? Are they difficult to find? How does one, you know, locate a place that they might go and see what it's all about?
Yes to both of those. There's a lot of them around, and yes, they can be really hard to find. I would recommend going to the Soaring Society of America, their website, checking them out. I just Googled soaring in Ohio, and I think there's three clubs just in northern Ohio. Two of them are fairly small, but ours is pretty big. And most glider pilots and glider clubs are social groups because it depends a lot on the weather. So get a phone number for somebody in the club, start calling them, and just get out there and do it. It can be a little intimidating at first, but it's usually very friendly people.
Well, I think most aviation people in general are pretty friendly.
Yeah, without a doubt. And also with the gliders, you know, with the way Facebook works now, if you can find somebody who's a glider enthusiast, you can usually work through the grapevine. You know, I know of clubs that are in Nevada and Southern California and Arizona, but I live in Ohio. So if somebody from Ohio was interested, I could put them in that direction and vice versa. Soaring is a pretty small group, so most people will know the majority of clubs in the area. If you can just find one resource that you're in. Mm-hmm. And then I think people can, and it's very affordable. It's infinitely more affordable than powered flight right now.
I would imagine. Yeah. Are the gliders, are they significantly cheaper than an airplane?
Yeah. Many times cheaper. There's no engine to worry about. The airframe doesn't wear out. I don't know what it cost us to annual our aircraft, but it's usually done in a few hours. It's nowhere near, it's way cheaper than a light sport aircraft. It's great. The club charges $700 a year, and that takes care of everything, and then it's $25 for a tow. And we've had guys fly for 4.5 to 5 hours on $25.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's like being in the 70s. It's phenomenal.
Yeah. Who provides the towing services?
The club. The club owns a tow plane. We use a Scout, a Decathlon, a Blanca Scout, which is a good tow plane. And then we've got, I think, about a half a dozen tow pilots. We always round one up for the weekend.
Yeah, that's a great way to build time if somebody's looking to do that, is to tow gliders or tow banners. I think towing gliders is probably a lot less risky than tow banners.
Yeah, I would second that.
Yeah, and why is that?
You know, the process of towing another airplane is much easier because it's very aerodynamic. When you're picking up a banner, it's not done the same way they tow a glider. Usually, and I don't know, you'll have to check me on this, Bryce, but I mean, the places I've been where they tow gliders, they hook the glider up to the back of the tow plane, and then the tow plane just sort of starts taxiing, and before you know it, it's taken off and dragging the glider behind it. Whereas on a banner tow, you have to swoop down at full power about 10 or 12 feet off the ground with a big hook out the back, and you grab this banner, which is not aerodynamic. It's like putting on the brakes. And if something goes wrong when you grab that banner, I mean, you're going to be in serious trouble.
Huh. Yeah, Robert's right on the money. Plus, you combine the fact that you're at a high speed low to the ground, and you're trying to catch something that's not rigid near the tail of the aircraft where all your vital control surfaces are. So it's not – now, I towing banners is something I was never interested in. Plus, you're at full power, really slow, fairly low. You know, and you are with a glider as well, but you're constantly climbing. A glider can fly at a much slower airspeed than an aircraft.
Yeah, I guess I never thought of it, but I didn't really consider that's how you towed a banner, that you actually swooped down and snatched it. I don't know how I thought you did it, but that's not what I thought.
You're supposed to ask me how I know that.
So, Rob, how do you know that?
I did that for 2 years when I was very young and very stupid.
Really? Yeah? Yeah?
Yeah.
How about once you get it up, up in the air? Bryce
said, you're really at maximum performance. I know that the topic's not really, you know, banner towing tonight, but I mean, you're operating it up at full power most of the time with this huge banner, and you're cruising along at, you know, maybe 6-7 knots above stall, and you're worried the engine's going to overheat, and if the engine so much as coughs, that airplane's going straight down because it has this huge chunk of drag out behind it. So that's one of the emergency procedures they teach you, which is similar to what they do with a glider tow pilot, is that if anything goes wrong, you yank the handle and you drop the banner, or in that case, you drop the glider, because you got to keep your airplane flying. And that's where it gets a little scary.
It's always fun watching on the Jersey Shore. They fly out of Cape May Airport. That's where they do and you can sit at the end of the runway. You can watch them scoop up. What they do is they drop the banner at one end of the runway, and by the other end of the runway, they have it hook up the new banner to go around the circuit again.
Yeah.
So it's a nonstop process, and a lot of the times these Super Cubs are sitting with full flaps and full rudder and side slipping as they're trying to tow this drink Budweiser beer banner down the Jersey Shore because of the wind. So it's truly good piloting skills for anybody who flies a banner plane.
But you know, like what Bryce said too, though. I mean, when you're a sailplane pilot, I'm sorry, glider pilot. In fact, what's the difference, Bryce? I don't know if I know the difference between a sailplane and a glider.
Well, the Schweizer company in New York kind of they put that to bed. Some of their aircraft they call gliders, and some of their aircraft they call sailplanes. It all depends on their sink rate, and I can't remember exactly what the number is, but it's soaring, gliding, sailplane, ship. They're all used interchangeably by glider pilots. You're never gonna, nobody's gonna really give you a hard time. There's really no technical difference.
Gliding, that's energy management education into the
end. All energy management. I've done not a lot, but I've done a good amount of glider aerobatics, and it is phenomenal. I find it. I like it better than powered aircraft aerobatics. It's not as stressful on the body. It's not as loud. Really, I really like it. I give you guys, if you ever get a chance to do it, I would recommend it.
Yeah, and I've actually done that once. That's in fact, I've been in a glider exactly once, and it was an aerobatic glider ride, which was just absolutely amazing. It sort of scared the hell out of me, but at the same time, it was just really, really thrilling.
It's great fun. I really like it a lot. And for the few times I do fly by myself with the club when I'm not teaching, I try to get upside down as much as possible.
Bryce, have you had any dramatic moments in a glider or anything notable?
Not in a glider. I tried to do a barrel roll in a Cessna 310 once, and that didn't turn out very well.
No, that didn't work well?
No. But I could do it now. I didn't do it very well then, but not really.
Thank God there's a statute of limitations on what you did. Right. Probably 10 years ago, right?
Oh, at least 20. At least 20.
Yeah, at least 20. There you go.
Wow. Bryce, any interesting aviation-related stuff coming up in your life?
Not really. I'm just going to keep on trucking out here with the Navy. I think we're doing good work and flying really great stuff. I've done so much traveling and so much flying in different places of different types. I'm really pretty happy with having a couple years of mellow domestic life. Just going home and flying with the guys in Cleveland and coming out to California and flying at 100 feet over the ocean in the fog every once in a while.
And how's that Twin Otter? How does that fly?
Great. It's a phenomenal aircraft. They have one, really knew what they were doing when they built that airplane. Very, very stable. Tremendous short field. With a lot of space on the inside for the scientists to work with and move around with. It's a very good, dependable, rugged aircraft.
Now, someone's building a new Twin Otter, right? Are you familiar with
Viking. Yeah, it's the 400 series,
Now, is that going to be true to the, is that going to be true to the sort of the historic Twin Otter, pedigree?
As far as I know, it's almost an exact duplicate of the 300 with upgraded avionics and some, some newer electrical stuff. But I believe it's the same PT-6 series engines, as far as I know. A lot of our manuals that we use at the shop are already Viking manuals. Viking's been a supplier for us for a while, and I know my last couple weeks in the Caribbean, a company down there that uses Twin Otters on floats was starting to switch to the new Vikings, and I've seen, I think the Army's getting a new Viking. As far as I know, it's almost an exact reproduction. Mm,
cool. All right. Hey, any of you guys have any questions for Bryce?
What's the scariest thing that's ever happened to you in flying?
Oh, in flying?
No, I didn't mean in life. I mean, I'm sure just driving on the freeway in Southern California is scary enough, but...
Back to that barrel roll in that 310, that was pretty intense because it turned out improperly. But really, I've never really been scared in an airplane. Well, once. I was a flight instructor, which is probably scary in itself, but... a friend of mine, one of the guys I worked with, we were ferrying a couple 172s from Youngstown, Ohio to Burke Lakefront in Cleveland, which is right on the lake in the wintertime. And the sun went down and it got cold, and we got a lot of ice on those 172s, and we had to divert. And I don't know if you guys ever had ice on a 172, but it doesn't work out very well. And we were You know, we both shot ILSs in Akron Canton, and I had about an inch of ice on the leading edge of that 172 and couldn't see out the windshield. And that was a little shaken when I got out of the airplane. But since then, you know, I think a big part of being a pilot that's not dead is knowing what you're doing. And when things get scary, stopping it.
Good point. I like that.
Yeah, yeah. Very wise.
I mean, if you're a pilot and you've got decades in the game and you're still scaring yourself, you should probably quit.
Yeah, I think so. All right, Bryce, I see that the Cleveland Soaring Society, that's at clevelandsoaring.org. Is that the right website?
That sounds right, yep.
Okay, any other place? Is there places that people can find you online, or just people should just take a look at the Cleveland Soaring Society site?
You know, check out the Cleveland Soaring Society site. That's a good resource. There's really no place to find me online. I keep a pretty low profile.
Okay.
The Cleveland Soaring Society, we're always looking for new members. We're always trying to grow. The bigger we get, the more fun it is. So I would welcome anybody from, you know, Pittsburgh, Western Pennsylvania, Northern Ohio, coming out to Geauga County on a Wednesday, Saturday, or Sunday. We're usually there.
All right. Very good. Bryce, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Max. I appreciate it.
And now, with This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode 19, July 10th through the 16th. July 10th through the 11th, 1914, an Albatross biplane is flown for 24 hours, 12 minutes. Flight is nonstop and unrefueled. The pilot of the aircraft is German Hart Bohm. Bohm's record would stand for 13 years until a tall American would fly for 33-plus hours in the Spirit of St. Louis. That pilot would be none other than Lucky Lindy. July 10th, 1940. The first skirmishes occur over the English Channel between the Luftwaffe and the Royal Air Force. The Kanalkampf would last until August 11th. The attacks on the Royal Navy were to attempt to develop techniques to fight the RAF and to provide experience to younger Luftwaffe pilots. ME-109s and Ju-87 Stukas attacked the Royal Navy shipping in the Channel. The successes of the Luftwaffe actually forced the Channel convoys to stop. One outcome of the Kanalkampf was the realization that the heavy fighter, or Zerstörer, destroyer, were not going to hold their own in the dogfights to come. The BF-110 and the Bolton Paul Defiant would eventually become night fighters instead of the heavy penetrators that were intended to be. These were the initial battles of the Battle of Britain and would continue till August 11th. July 12th, 1994, a Royal Air Force Hercules C-4 flies the 100,000th mission in support of Operation Provide Promise. This was a mission to support refugees in the former Yugoslavia. Provide Promise was started on July 2nd, 1992. The resupply mission was to be concluded by 21 nations and would last until 1996. In total, 159,000 plus tons of food were flown into Sarajevo by NATO's and NATO-supporting countries. July 14, 1984, United Airlines becomes the launch customer for Boeing's new wide-body twin-engine jet, the 767. Originally, United was refusing to purchase the aircraft over its two-crew arrangement. Instead of there needing to be a flight engineer, United was concerned over the additional workload of flying an aircraft over long distances with only two engines and two crew. July 15, 1970, the Tupolev Tu-144 becomes the first jet airliner to pass Mach 2 in level flight. The Concordski, as it would become known, was a direct competitor to the Concorde. Overall, the Tu-144 was slightly bigger and slightly faster than the Concorde. First flights that occurred during the week of July 10th through the 16th. July 12th, 1980, the McDonnell Douglas KC-10A Extend, the first supertanker, flies to supplement then-aging KC-135s. And on July 15th, 1954, the Boeing 360-80, or the -80, the grandfather of the Boeing 707 and KC-135s. And that's the way it was, July 10th through the 16th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian. Any comments, questions, or suggestions, please email me at airplanegeekshistorian@gmail.com. And if you want to give me a ride, I will be in Oshkosh in 2 weeks from today.
Oh, very good. Thanks, David. So what was the difference between the Dash 80 and what eventually became the 707? Was there a big difference in those?
Well, the Dash 80 is directly related to the KC-135. The Boeing 707 actually is slightly wider in dimensions. So the 135 and the 707 are not the same airframe. They have a lot of commonality, but dimensionally, the 707 is fatter, so they could get two additional rows of seats in.
Oh, I didn't know that. I think I'd always assumed they were identical. Huh.
Unless you look at the cross-section, you really can't tell.
Okay, thanks.
Just to add something?
Is it something productive?
Yes.
Okay, Dan?
So, a couple things. Number one, first, random fact of the day, United was also the launch customer for the 777.
Yes.
But the other thing about with the two crew issue, that was also a union issue at the time as well.
Well, actually, what's really ironic, if you really want to go a little further, there actually were 767s built for Ansett Airlines with a three crew cockpit, because at the time Ansett's unions would not fly the aircraft unless it had a crew of three. So there was a small portion of Boeing 767s that had a three-man cockpit only, but they were only flown by Ansett in Australia.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline July 10th, 2010. Well, g'day folks, it's Steve Vischer here with the Airplane Geeks Australia Desk for episode 155. Now, this one's going to be a bit of a bits and pieces episode of our own, actually, because unfortunately Grant and I have not been able to sync up tonight to record our segment as usual, which is pretty rare, but sometimes these things happen. So Grant's pre-recorded a little segment here. He's going to talk about Tiger Airways and their current troubles, and boy, if you thought they were in trouble last week when we spoke to you, well, it's even worse now for them, with their grounding being extended. So, Grant, take it away.
Hey, gang. Well, unfortunately, Steve and I weren't able to synchronize our time schedules and get ourselves recording tonight at the same time. So, here's my little bit about Tiger. Yes, Tiger. Grounded last week, continuing to be grounded this week, grounded ongoing all the way into August. In fact, they're going to be grounded right through Oshkosh. Unless something goes very right for them, they won't be allowed to fly again until August the 1st, and many are saying they're not going to be flying ever. That's it. It's time to end. I don't know. We'll see what happens. They've got some pretty good people working there, but unfortunately their management structures and so on have let them down, it would appear. A little bit of arrogance and ego that we've seen. Crawford Ricks, the Australian CEO, is gone. He's out by the end of the month, while Tony Davis, the CEO of the entire group, has come down from Asia and he is now running things here. Many say he's the one who's caused most of the problems, so whether his head's on a platter or not, or whether Crawford Ricks and a few others are going to be the scapegoats, remains to be seen. Pretty full-on stuff going on here, folks. Tiger were getting in trouble with the ACCC, the Competition Council, because they were trying to sell tickets for after the 9th of July. Their initial grounding was only till the 9th, and the ACCC stepped in and said, hang on, how can you sell tickets when you don't really know that you're going to be flying? That's not good. So once again, they've gone up against the ACCC and had their paw smacked, you might say, and they've had to stop selling all tickets until everything gets resolved. It has been confirmed that it was the same pilot who did the last two altitude violations. However, the first one that most people know about, on approach into Melbourne, they descended to 2,000. On their paper charts, it said 2,500. In the computer system, using a third-party database, it had 2,000 as the minimum altitude. That error came in through an update of the database that was not caught. The Safety Bureau and CASA are saying that these guys should have had a process in place to check any third-party database base updates so that it would have been caught. Either way, that was the reason for the first altitude bust. The second one, which apparently was the same captain flying, they haven't really got a direct explanation for that one at the moment. But yeah, amazing stuff. Tiger's still grounded. The other two airlines are enjoying it, picking up more passengers. And in case you hadn't noticed, a lot of the airfares have gone up. They were quite low at first, but now that Tiger's been grounded, those fares have started going up. Surprise, surprise. Anyhow, folks, we'll keep you posted. Hopefully next AusDesk we'll be able to synchronize our watches and get in on the same time zone. For now, I'm Grant McHaren, signing off.
Well, thanks, mate. And, yeah, there you go. So Tiger Airways now, it's come out tonight too that the pilot in question here that busted Minimus that we talked about last week, turns out that there'd been an incident a few weeks earlier at Melbourne Airport. And as it turns out, it was the same pilot that was involved in that incident as well, coming in what we believe to be 500 feet below the that particular step altitude, which was 2,500 feet for the sector he was in, coming into Melbourne Airport this day. Now, these two incidents on their own, you would think wouldn't be enough just to ground the airline, but yeah, there are a lot of other factors at play there, not the least of which is politics, of course. You know, some people have speculated that CASA is doing a great job here and showing how tough they are by grounding an airline. I'd probably make the point here that it's an airline with only 10 aircraft in it, and it would be interesting to see if they took such a harsh line with a larger airline like Virgin or Qantas. Qantas, of course, being the largest airline collectively in this country. So anyway, we'll see where that goes. Now, the other news that's big down here at the moment is, of course, today has been known as Carbon Sunday. In my opinion, a rather dark day in Australia's political history. Today is the day that the much-vaunted carbon tax was announced by Prime Minister Julia Gillard. And the aviation angle here is quite interesting because the carbon tax will be applied to, amongst other things, fuel, but not all fuel. There's been a lot of political argy-bargy going on to try and limit the damaging impact of a carbon tax. And so what they've decided to do, at least with motor vehicle fuel, is exempt standard petrol or gasoline if you're American, and some diesel fuel depending on who's using it. With regard to aviation fuel, just looking here at an article that's been published in the Daily Telegraph, which is a Sydney paper, a News Limited publication, they're saying here that the carbon tax will apply to aviation fuel for domestic aircraft but not for international aircraft. So it's interesting to see what they're looking at doing here. I would assume that's because, and Qantas has been quite vocal here, particularly Qantas, they're already quite heavily exposed when it comes to this sort of stuff, and their opinion, and I'd have to say, being an opponent of carbon tax, I'd have to agree with this, this would make it even more difficult for them to compete with their international rivals if they're going to have to pay an Australian carbon tax on top of the jet fuel that they're buying already. So it's looking like at the moment that at the $23 per ton level that they're starting with, this would add about 6 cents a litre to the cost of the various different aviation fuels, increasing to more than 10 cents by 2014, 2015. And then from 2015 onwards, there'll be an increase every 6 months. So, yeah, this is not a good thing. And, of course, both the airlines have said, and like many other businesses in this country, that they're not in a position to absorb this cost and they'll have no other choice but to pass it on to consumers. So, yeah, a pretty dark day in my humble opinion. I'm sure that a lot of people have lots of other opinions on that. There's been a lot of opinion flying around Australia at the moment with regard to this. And, boy, we're in for some interesting times. But there you go. So we'll leave it there for this week. Hopefully Grant and I will be back together next week. And, of course, the week after, we'll be on a plane and heading across to the United States to head off to Oshkosh. But fear not, the Australia desk will still be along for you. In fact, another member of the PCDU team will be filling in. We'll just leave that a mystery for now. But we think the studio will be here in good hands. So until next week, on behalf of Grant McCarran, I'm Steve Vischer. Cheers, folks.
Well, thanks to Steve and Grant for the Australia desk report. Rob, it sounds like the Tiger Airways folks are in kind of a bit of a pickle. You know, going back to your days flying commercially, what would have been the repercussions to you, I guess, personally?
An altitude bust? Well, yeah. One altitude bust, they would not be happy. I mean, you would normally, you could be suspended without pay for that. I mean,
And the reason is because there might be another airplane at that other altitude?
Well, oh, absolutely. Yeah, and okay. And besides, I mean, the crew is supposed to be paying enough attention that if the, especially if they're on autopilot, you don't just punch the autopilot and then, you know, start reading the newspaper. You need to make sure that it captures on the altitude you wanted. And that's a traditional call is, coming up on 350. Okay, and then you wait for the light, and you go, captured on 35, just to confirm that the autopilot's going to round the airplane mm-hmm. out. And if it doesn't do that, you know, the crew's got to be right on top of it to grab it. But two busts with the same guy, that's somebody that's
something
not
serious.
Paying attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now, as Steve said, I'm sure there's got to be a lot more than that, because two altitude busts with one pilot is not enough. for any agency to ground the airline. There's something else going on.
Yeah, you'd think you'd go after the pilot, I guess.
But well, and I'm sure they would have, or maybe they did, but still, again, that's not enough to shut the airline down. My guess is that there were many other things going on as well.
Okay.
Max, before we go to Peter, let me ask Dan and Rob a question, since they're the experts.
Sure, David.
What do you want?
Is it? Wow.
Ooh. He's a little cranky. He was late last night.
I was late last night.
Okay, here's the question.
Yes.
Has this kind of grounding by a civil authority ever happened here in the States?
Well, let me think about that.
There have been groundings of aircraft in the past, like,
but not a whole. The FAA's never taken out a whole airline, have they?
ValuJet, I believe, was grounded for at least a period.
That's the only one I can think of as well.
Yeah, I think ValuJet was grounded in sometime in 1996.
After the crash in the Keys?
Yeah, it went down the Everglades.
Yes, I think it was about
that was when they had those oxygen generators on board. But the same thing, that alone was probably, as terrible as that was, that alone was not enough to ground that airline. There had to be other violations in there somewhere where the FAA said, enough.
And over the past few years, we have seen some groundings of either a certain set individual aircraft, well, like a block of aircraft, if it's found that they aren't in full compliance with a certain airworthiness directive or something.
Sure,
like that.
What American did with those MD-80s a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, exactly.
And Southwest with the 737s just...
Right.
Yeah, right around the same time as the American issue in 2008, if my memory serves correctly.
But the FAA hasn't ever taken, other than the ValuJet, the FAA, it just, even if, I know they're sort of downplaying because it's 10 jets, but it is kind of impressive that a civil air authority is literally taking out an airline and making it unfeasible to exist anymore.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I can't think of the last, when was, that, I'm trying to think, there have been some, Now you're going to,
yes.
Regions Air was grounded in 2007, I believe. Regions Air, which had previously operated as American Connection, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Also, Air Tahoma, which I had never heard of until 5 seconds ago, was grounded in 2009. So.
Okay, but small fry, relatively.
Yeah. The last major carrier I think of is ValuJet.
Okay.
Peter, wonder if there's any we'll segue to Peter now and go across the pond. Peter, has the British Aviation Authority ever grounded an airline in Great Britain?
You're not expecting an answer right now, right?
No.
Okay. That's Peter's homework. But meantime, here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
We all love aviation for a reason, some for the thrill, others for the challenge. But what's common to all of us is the heritage we share in aviation. Today, I'm joined by Dave Robinson, who has a wealth of knowledge and experience in the industry, and today we're going to talk about aviationancestry.com. Dave is calling us today from Nottinghamshire in the UK. Dave, welcome to Across the Pond.
Hi, Peter.
Well, thanks for joining us. Dave, you seem to walk right into aviation ancestry, literally. How did this all begin?
Well, I've always been an avid reader. I've had a long-standing interest in aviation and an avid reader of anything to do with aviation. One day I popped into a local bookshop in Nottingham. Much to my surprise, he told me that he was closing down. He had some aviation items he thought I might be interested in, and took a little wander into his storeroom, and there were shelves upon shelves of magazines, but these looked incredibly interesting, especially as the dates were from 1909 onwards, in other words, right from the very birth of aviation.
Wow.
And did I want them? And it just so happened that probably for the first time in my life, I actually had a little bit of disposable cash.
Yeah.
Bit the bullet on the spot and thought that I could invest about £1,000 in buying up this collection of magazines, which numbered somewhere around 600. And that included brochures and books and boxes of various posters and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Can you describe what material you have and how it's categorized?
It was some years later when I stopped actively flying to take on self-employment in writing software and web development,
right,
that I thought it might be a good thing to do to combine my interest in aircraft and the internet. And it occurred to me that the advertisements, which were so often chopped out of magazines by the collectors, were actually amongst the most interesting items therein.
Yeah.
Because they would, at any given time, give a snapshot of the company's activities and, as part of a series, would actually catalogue the development of the company itself. And unless you sort of have an understanding of the British aviation industry pre-1970, it's staggering to know just how many aircraft-related companies there were. Just how many aircraft manufacturers there were, how many airlines there were, how many people were producing the clothing, the diversity of flying schools, and, of course, the component manufacturers.
And I think that's the thing from the website that I think really grabs the viewer. I mean, it's quite an amazing collection of every single aspect of aviation between 1900 and 1970.
If you're going to fly to Europe or London, this is the plane you ought to be on, the BOAC VC-10.
What are your gems? What are your favourite examples and adverts and so forth?
Well, the favourites are the ones that take you by surprise. I think the most stunning example of these are the Helliwells adverts. And Helliwells were fabricators, metal fabricators. They were latterly based at the now disappeared Walsall Airport near Birmingham.
Right.
And in 1939, they commissioned, just at the outbreak of the war, when things were looking really bleak, a series of adverts featuring naked ladies. Really stunning ones. And these are absolutely classic ads that even after nearly 80 years are still remembered by many. They're that famous. The ads were that significant as morale boosters at the time. All terribly tasteful, of course. The pilot recruitment ads. There's a couple of handball ones that are very, very popular because it was the one that caused... They were the ones that attracted people to go to handball to work for the then BOAC.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the typical pilot in the sports car, VC-10 in the background.
Yes.
You know, with the girl in the, you know, with the blonde in the, in the other seat.
Yeah.
And, you know, hundreds of people have asked for that one, you know, because, of course, they're just coming up to retirement now. Martin Baker have redone their restaurant, and they had all the ejection seat ads to get blown up as posters. Selfridges had their 100th anniversary recently, and Selfridges were huge suppliers of aviation equipment.
Yeah,
they used to have a flight simulator on the roof of Selfridges in London, and they were sole suppliers of Irving parachutes, clothing, and all sorts. And in fact, Selfridge himself was the very first British commercial airline passenger.
This is Across the Pond. Aviation news with just a dash of culture.
It is quite an amazing collection that you have. I particularly like the Fairy Swordfish posters because of my dad, but the old airline posters as well. They're quite amazing. Can people get copies of the posters and prints from your website?
Sure, they can, yes. I mean, all they have to do is drop me an email, telling me exactly which ones they'd like, and I'll locate the high resolution copies and email them.
Dave, I'm really glad you've taken this project on and maintained a real aviation heritage in the collection. Where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm at Aviation Ancestry. That's all one word, aviationancestry.com.
And can they find you on Twitter as well?
Yep, I'm Aero Ancestry.
Dave, thanks so much for joining us today.
No, it's been a pleasure.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
You can find Peter Johnson on Twitter at Nascot Hornet and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com.
I like that lady he has that does the little outro there. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, very nice.
I wonder who that is.
I don't know.
Peter, who is that?
David, have you been to Aviation Ancestry? Have you seen that site? It's pretty interesting.
No, but after the show, I will be heading out there immediately.
All right, we want to thank Peter Johnson for that. That was fantastic. And yeah, aviationancestry.com is very interesting. There really is a lot of history just in the advertising. It's kind of amazing. Okay, on to listener mail. First comes from Brett.
Whoa. Where's the music?
I don't have any music for... We need music for listener mail.
Oh.
Something okay. Appropriately... mailish.
Okay.
First email comes from Brett. This is in response to our discussion about Ryanair blocking off seats, and we'd heard from another listener about that. Brett writes, "I love the Airplane Geeks and Plane Crazy Down Under, and have been an avid listener now for the past 12 months." He says, "I live in the UK and am a 737-800 captain for Ryanair and can answer a question that was raised in episode 151 about the reason for the blocking of seats on certain flights. You guys were correct. It has to do with weight and balance, and under certain conditions allows us to expand the center of gravity limits if required." So Brett provided a lot of information, basically confirms what our earlier listener had sent us. So we want to thank Brett for that. Rob, any or David or Dan, any comments on the information that Brett provided?
I still can't believe that they weight and balance 737s.
I know it does seem kind of
it's done for every aircraft type. I mean,
I know, but it just seems so. I mean, to us non pilots, it seems crude.
I was going to say if it was a Cessna, I would understand it. It's a Boeing 737. It should have enough thrust to not need to be weight and balanced. I think it's just another Ryanair way to control the herd of cattle into the airplane.
No, I would very much disagree. For
you,
sure.
I would disagree.
I disagree.
Okay.
I mean, granted, you see it more in the regional jets for the rebalancing, but I mean, you got to do it for every airplane. And yeah, this is just in Ryanair's case, it seems to be an easier way to get it done quickly.
Yeah, it's really just arithmetic, and there are times that you might have what they were talking about the version that seats 180 or something, I think.
189.
Yeah, 189, and so you could there would be times you might have 120 on board and not need to block seats, depending on how much fuel you needed for the leg. There might be enough fuel in the right places to balance it out. But sometimes on shorter legs, it just comes up and you go, you're stuck, got to do it. And it's not about thrust, it's all about balance.
Come on. Alaska Airlines has never balanced one of their 737s.
Oh, that's not. You just don't see it. You just don't see it.
You don't see it, but yeah,
but
it happens.
I flew a combi out of Ketchikan. We weren't weight and balanced, and half of the airplane was empty.
I'm sure you were weight and balanced at some point.
But see, that was the problem right there. You were in kind of a catch-as-catch-can situation.
Oh, okay.
And, okay. And that, there was...
Dan, if you're going to balance an airplane, you need to know the weights that have gone into the airplane.
That's right.
Yeah, how do they do that? They just figure
I haven't
average...
ever gotten on a scale to get on a 737.
They have a rough idea. Everybody
weighs
about 135.
There are... there are airport planning documents for airplanes that do. And they actually assume that you are weighed a certain amount. So, and also, of course, how you load bags are also an issue. So, yeah, it does happen. It's behind the scenes.
Hmm. Okay. I mean, it kind of makes sense. I wonder what proportion of the total weight of the aircraft is taken up by the passengers. I mean, David, I mean, this would sort of support, you know, the argument that it, you know, that it happens all the time and that it's necessary if the...
Actually, not much.
Not much?
No, no. Most of the weight of the
fuel.
The takeoff is the basic weight of the airplane and the fuel. The passengers and the bags are not that big a deal.
Because you think if it's not that big a deal, if it's a small percentage, then balancing passengers
but
would
again,
have a small
it's
effect.
It's like a seesaw. You know, if you put a weight close to the pivot point, it doesn't make a big deal. But if you put that same, even a smaller weight, way out at the end of the teeter-totter, it can make a huge difference. And that's the same thing with the airplane. And actually, the real reason is it's all about controlling the tailplane. If you have too much weight in the nose, you may not be able to get enough elevator up to raise the nose, or vice versa. If you have too much weight in the tail, mm-hmm. you may not have enough elevator to get the nose down. And it's the teeter-totter effect is really what it is.
Then tell me why the hell Southwest doesn't balance every one of their flights.
But they do. They just don't block seats. I mean, that's the difference.
Well, okay, but that's what we're talking about.
Well,
Ryanair is making an issue about having to block seats to balance the airplane.
Well, you know I think David has a very valid point. And you know what I am going to do? I'm going to make myself a note. I know somebody that flies that model airplane, and we're going to do some weight and balance stuff just to see what things affect it, I want to know that myself.
But just to add to the speculation, and maybe one of our listeners can answer this, in terms of Ryanair, just I'm going to assume because they're a short-haul network that charges large amounts of dollars for bags, I'm going to assume that they do not have a lot of baggage, which could play into an issue on the weight and balance
could be a factor.
Issue.
All right, so Rob's going to do some homework for us. This is good. This will be a learning experience. Brett, you started?
I mean, the last airline that I got asked how much I weigh, I won't get into. Okay. Rob.
Okay.
All right. Well, so we'll defer this to a kind of a focused discussion on weight and balance in airliners and how that's handled and how that works. It can
did
be.
We say, hey, Dan, did we say these are Ryanair's are 800s? Is that what they are? 737-800s?
Ryanair has all 800s, yeah.
Yeah, 800s.
Okay. All right. I will get the answer.
All right, good. Well, that was lively.
But yes, actually, I am currently on Google Books looking at what a preview page of the Southwest Airlines way that talks about how Southwest computes weight and balance. Just saying.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So we'll report on that next time.
To be continued.
To be continued. Meanwhile, we also got an email from Peter on anti-collision lights. He says, hello, geeks. I've been enjoying your podcast for about 6 months now. I'm a mechanic with United Airlines and have been for almost 26 years. Congratulations. I've recently heard you question why an aircraft, I believe it was an Airbus, had two anti-collision beacons on top of the fuselage. I know the word beacon must excite Dan because it resembles the word bacon. So I just want to... I love that, Peter. So I just want to...
true.
That's right. Dan likes bait. So I just want to mention the L-1011 also had two beacons. I almost said bacons. And it was just for redundancy. This may also be the case for the aircraft you're questioning. Keep up the great work, Peter.
I think from what we've found is for the Qatar A330-200, I believe, and it's also, I think, on the A340-600, it appears to be unique to that airline from what we've been able to find. And so it does not appear
precisely why.
Best theory I've been able to find is it has to do with Qatar's IFE system.
Right. So that the beacon lights
antenna,
clear the bubble.
Yeah, some something on the top of the fuselage that might get in the way of the single beacon. That was kind of my guess too.
I'm not sure if it's that reason, if it's like this, the SATCOM blocks blocks the view from some angles, but I'm guessing it could have something to do with that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we thank Peter for adding to that conversation. Also got a nice note from Jay.
Did you have anything you wanted to say, David, about that? Did you want to jump in there?
You mean like an argue?
No, I don't think you wanted to argue, but, you know, David's an opinionated guy.
I've seen the light. It has to be correct.
You want to throw your weight around a little bit?
Oh, you're funny, man.
Oh, this is.
Oh, God. I'm sorry.
We're spiraling out of control.
It's 2 weeks until Oshkosh. I'm sorry. I'm getting goofy.
Everyone's excited.
Well, it's been 2 weeks since we've been on the same phone together.
That's
so.
Right. We had to do our bits and pieces last time. Jay says, hello, airplane geeks. I wanted to give you all a heads up on that the television show CNBC Titans will be featuring Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines fame on their next episode. It will air on Thursday, July 14th, that's 2011, at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on CNBC. I know you have all talked quite a bit about Herb, and I thought this might be a good opportunity for your listeners to learn more about the man and the airline that he created. I love the show. Keep up the good work. So thanks to Jay for passing that along. That should be great. You're going to be watching, aren't you, Dan?
I don't own a TV, but I believe a lot of the CNBC specials end up on Hulu. So I'm going to, fingers crossed for that.
Oh, okay. Great. Well, we appreciate Jay sending that in.
And those of us that do own TVs will be watching.
Right. Jeremy writes in, since it is fire season in certain parts of the United States, I think it would be cool to talk to a firefighting aircraft pilot sometime. I think that's a great idea. I think we should try to find one and learn something about aerial firefighting. You guys good for that?
I think that's a cool idea. And was he the one, or someone else mentioned the Evergreen airplanes?
Oh, that was me. That was in my response back to Jeremy.
Okay. Yeah. I think they're the ones that have that set four that's a tanker.
Yes.
A water tanker.
So maybe we can get someone associated with that or the pilot or something. So we'll try that. So thanks, Jeremy, for that great idea. And then finally, from Tony. Tony says, I'm a longtime listener of your podcast and look forward to every episode. Listening to your banter along watching SQ-1 taking off is a perfect way to cap off a night walking my dog in the Millbrae Hills overlooking San Francisco Airport. I came across this Chinese animation that would make any airplane geek's day. It's kind of propagandish, but 10 points for originality. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Now, it's pretty complicated link, so you can't really read it over the podcast here, but we'll put this in the show notes and be sure to look at this. I think this is, well, I don't know. It's entertaining for sure. It's kind of hysterical. I won't give you the whole thing, but it's an animation, and it's loaded with jets, all kinds of jets, tankers, F-16s, F-117s, Raptors, the whole thing, some Chinese. It's an aerial sort of little story that plays out. And it's definitely, you know, if you're waving the stars and stripes, you may not like the outcome of this, but it's a really entertaining little piece of animation. I think it runs about,
7 minutes.
7 minutes, right. Did you take a look at that, David?
Oh, it was hysterical. I was really partial to the Sidewinder missiles.
Yes. They were snakes, right?
Yeah, they're Sidewinder snakes. You have to understand where it's coming from, folks. But it definitely has a pro-China spin.
Yes, military
spin. It is pretty funny, and it involves tankers.
It does.
So that's always a good thing.
Yeah. All right, so we want to thank Tony for sending that along, and as I mentioned before, we'll put that in the show notes. Go find it, click on it. It's kind of worth watching.
Also, just to interject.
Yes.
I just found a thread on Flyer Talk about Alaska Airlines, about directing people to seats due to rate and balance considerations.
You just couldn't let this go until next week.
I couldn't let it go. I could not let it go.
Okay. Oh, Dan, you're so funny.
I'm sorry. That may have sounded like a snicker. That was it was a cough. My apologies. I'm sorry.
All right, I think that's our show.
Stay tuned next week when we have the weight and balance squabbles continue.
That's right.
Same time, same bat podcast.
All right. Well, listen, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Bryce Couillat. You can learn more about the Cleveland Soaring Society at www.clevelandsoaring.org. Check that out. We'd also like to thank Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron from PlaneCrazyDownUnder.com for their Australia Desk Report. And also Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. We really enjoy Peter's coverage of European aviation. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
I can be found on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. I can be found surfing my Twitter account at DM Vanderhoof. I'm looking forward to Oshkosh in 2 weeks, spending a lot of time staring at the hashtag Osh11. So anyone, and if you want to meet us, Rob and I will, and Dan will have lots of pins. So just come up, and we're looking forward to meeting everybody out at Oshkosh.
Well, that's assuming, of course, David, that you get past my dog, because you're going to be staying with us for a few days before you go up to Oshkosh, aren't you?
That's true. I might have to lose some additional weight as he eats me alive.
Yeah. Yeah. What's an extra arm?
And Dan Webb, where do people find you online?
Behind you.
Okay. Anywhere
or
else?
ThingsInTheSky.com.
Yeah.
Dan Webbage on Twitter.
Fantastic. And Rob Mark, where are all the places in the entire internet where people can find Rob Mark?
Well, let's see. Our company site is comavia.com, which hardly anybody knows about because we just never talk about it a lot. But we're going to talk about it a lot more someday, I'm sure. But for now, we're just going to talk about jetwine.com. And we're going to talk about Jetwine on Twitter. And we're going to talk about the fact that Dan is not coming to stay with us before.
Okay. And Comavia, that's with two M's, right?
That's with two M's, that's right.
Because one M is someone else.
That's right.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. And I'm also on Twitter at Max Flight. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. Links to the sites that we mentioned on the podcast. Also listener comments, Airplane Geeks t-shirts, and a few photos each episode. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream the podcast to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line, where you can leave us an audio message.
Gee, what's that number?
This used to be really easy.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361 Geeks01.
Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Now, let's see. Our guest this episode is Bryce. But you know what, Bryce?
Is he still here? I thought Bryce left.
Bryce, I forgot to ask you how to pronounce your last name. Is it Kujat?
Last name's Kujat.
Kujat?
Yeah, the J is kind of like a Y.
Okay, I got it. Okay, ready for some Australians?
No. Not going to make any difference, though, is it?
Do means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's
Robert.
Rob?
What? You know, I've been hitting this stupid button on my headphone to try to unmute it, and it wasn't unmuting, and I was trying to go through the options here, so I don't know what happened.
All right,
I guess it's not
back.
A good mic night. Sorry. Here I am.
By the way, don't be worried about sounding like a moron.
Yeah, our listeners expect it, Rob. No. So, do you have an answer for the? Do you remember the question I asked?
No. The answer would be 42. Oh, sorry.
No, I guess not.
No, actually, I can't even say that. That name rings a bell.
Rob, what's with the Hitchhiker's references all of a sudden?
I wondered if anybody was going to get that.
Oh, come on. You should know that of all the people, I'll get it, with my other show being The Hitchhiker's Guide to Military Aviation.
I know. How does that go? Dub, 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 dub.
Dub, dub, dub.
Oh, my gosh. You know what we forgot to do?
What did we forget to do?
Nothing that I can think of.
Oh, okay. I just wondered.
Also, by the way, I was talking with Aunt Benet the other day and gave her a pop quiz, and she did remember our phone number properly. So
very good.
She has learned.
You know what? I think it's her birthday this week.
Aunt Benet's birthday?
Yeah. Either her or the Princess of Plains. I'm not sure. I think it's Aunt Benet's birthday. We should do something.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you.
Wow, that's gotta love that passion.